I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with Penny Abay-Wardena, New York City's Commissioner for International Affairs. In her role, she and her team have launched a series of initiatives focused on connecting New Yorkers and city agencies to the diplomatic community, as well as more effectively serving New York City's diplomatic corps, which is the largest in the world.
Prior to joining Mayor Bill de Blasio's administration, Penny was the Director of Girls and Women Integration at the Clinton Global Initiative, and before that worked for Human Rights Watch. She also serves on the board of the United Nations Development Corporation and recently joined the board of the Center for Reproductive Rights.
In terms of understanding U.S. diplomatic relations, and particularly New York City's role on the international stage, Penny has a unique perspective that only someone with her entrepreneurial spirit and in her position could have. Let's get her on the line. Hi, Penny. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Thanks, Spencer. It's a pleasure to join you guys via Zoom.
So you're coming off what I'm sure was a particularly busy month with the recent UN General Assembly. And so I wanted to start there. What were some of your big takeaways from this year's meeting? And did you come to it with any particular areas of focus?
Well, you know, UNGA is my Super Bowl. So this is my seventh and my last. So you're catching me on the end. Just as some background, I've been the commissioner since 2014, and I was appointed during the 2014 UN General Assembly. You know, going into this UNGA, there are a lot of things. Obviously, when you think about the foreign policy implications of everything that's happened from Afghanistan to Haiti to what's going on around the world. But from a New York City perspective, it's really been about the operational and collaborative relationship we've had with our diplomatic corps starting last March when we became the epicenter of the pandemic here in the US. We host the largest diplomatic corps. So what did it mean to have them all here? Fast forward, I could talk about what that relationship looks like, but this UN General Assembly is arguably the largest convening of international travelers in the US since the pandemic hit. And so what does that mean from a public health perspective? How do we keep New Yorkers safe? But how do we also host and welcome, you know, what we know and what we believe within the de Blasio administration is an incredibly important convening, something we didn't want to say don't do, but we wanted to say, please work with us to do it as safely as possible. So between everything from climate change to the safety of the diplomats navigating New York City, there was a lot going on these last few months.
And if we go out a bit further and look at the past few years, particularly international diplomacy during the previous White House administration, what was that like?
That was so diplomatically said.
How did you get through that particular period? And what did you learn from having to navigate and operate in those conditions?
So as I mentioned, I started in 2014. The agency I run, we've been around for about 60 years. New York City's host to the largest diplomatic corps, not only the UN, but the consular corps. We have about 100 economic trade commissioners, all that good stuff. When I came in, it was largely operational. How does New York City navigate everything from diplomatic incidents to the infamous parking program, right? All very important. But that was the only real connection with our diplomatic core was this operational dynamic. And so that's something that we changed in the early years in terms of how can we more substantively connect with different countries? How do we exchange best practices? How can we connect? You know, New York City is as large, if not larger, than 140 countries. So if we can get something done here, you know, that's something that you can do in Nairobi or Paris and vice versa. And I give you that background because the first couple of years as commissioner, it was a lot of fun. We were creating all these programs, the Junior Ambassador Program, Global Vision Urban Action, where New York City started to show our leadership on achieving the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs, the entire world agreed to back in 2015. So that was a really exciting relationship building couple of years. And then we had this very significant shift when the Trump administration came in. And that was a period that was extremely difficult for me, as I was undocumented as a child. I'm a survivor of domestic violence. There are just so many aspects of my lived experience that he offended from like day one. And I thought it was going to be really hard working under those conditions. And something that I didn't appreciate until it happened was how much a trusted working reputation with different member states, with the secretariat at the UN, different consulates would come into play. Mm. Because one of the first things that we saw from a city perspective is how terrorized our communities became, right? One of the first things that he went after was temporary protected status, Liberia, Haiti, a few other countries, as well as DACA, our dreamers that were here in New York City. And so we're in the US, but we saw what was happening at a city level. And so there was such an opportunity, and it became very clear early on, for local leadership to represent what American values are. Mm. One of the, I would say, most striking examples we had was the Paris Climate Accord. There was a lot of, I don't know if you guys remember, but it's like Ivanka and Jared are going to make sure that he stays in it because they're like the common sense climate believers in the administration. But we were saying some of the things that he was passing at the policy level. And so we anticipated that he was going to be pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. When he did, we were prepared. And within 24 hours, we became the first American city to sign directly to the Paris Climate Agreement. That is significant because that gave us the opportunity to say, hey, that's happening at the national level. We have a federal government abdicating its responsibility. It doesn't mean that we around the US at the local government are going to do the same. And so we worked with the US Conference of Mayors. And I believe to date, there are close to 400 US cities and towns of all sizes, of all political representation, that have signed on to the Paris Climate Agreement. This was obviously pre-Biden. Biden put us back in. That, I think, just shows how much of an opportunity, I hate to say, the Trump administration became for those of us at the city and local government level to step up and sort of step into the power that we had.
So refreshing to hear it as an opportunity.
It feels weird to say it like that, but it is actually really accurate, you know? And while I would never have wanted some of the systems to burn down the way he burned them down, for us to not use that to our advantage, to step up on behalf of our communities, would have been a shame. So it sounds like a very light thing I'm saying after the fact, but in that moment, I don't know, there was this intense confusion and anger. Like, he did what? We can't do that. Can we do that?
And you could argue that if that hadn't happened, we wouldn't have been so prepared for the power of the state level at the beginning of the pandemic, which was so clear. I mean, the average American probably didn't think, you know, is New York making a decision for me over the federal government? But that's exactly what happened. And I wonder if the Paris moment with the Paris Climate Accord sort of was the trigger for that, or helped prepare you guys for knowing that you were kind of in power and on your own when the pandemic started.
You know, I actually think that distinction we were aware of in government. I can only speak for New York City. I can only speak for the de Blasio administration. And the reason I've worked for this administration for as long as I have, and I've never worked in government before, is because we fundamentally believe that government should work for the people. So one of the first priorities we did, we created one of the first universal pre-K programs in the country. Mm. We got rid of stop and frisk and invested in community policing, right? The NYPD is one of the largest police forces in the country, if not in the world. It's the mayor of New York City. And I don't know if you remember, but Jeff Sessions and Trump really tried to go after some of our policing policies, couldn't, because that's something that is controlled at a local level. And so I think we knew the power we had, and we were trying to pre-Trump, you know, exert it, whether it came to one of our big policies that I'm very proud of is IDNYC. It was something that we prioritized in the first couple of years, but it was to ensure that all New Yorkers, irrespective of their documentation status, had access to an ID card. Because as you know, you cannot navigate any sort of community in a dignified fashion if you don't have an ID card. You can't even pick up your kids from school, much less access health services, right? And so we were doing that kind of work. What I think Trump did was, and then COVID shifted into sort of the everyday community had to focus on, oh, we do actually have a lot of power in our community. I think that's what, to a certain extent, he really heightened that that distinction. If you have a national government abdicating its responsibility, and I want to talk about COVID because my team and I mean, I became like chief procurement executive from foreign governments for PPE when our national government was literally outbidding us, you know, for ventilator parts and refusing to give us enough PPE to take care of our healthcare workers, you know, at Elmhurst Hospital. So that I think is the distinction. We knew it as an administration, as a government. I just think people hadn't made that connection yet.
So could you run us through what an average day is like for you as the city's commissioner for international affairs when it's not the UN General Assembly?
You know, it's changed. It's different. There's always a lot of meetings. The purpose of the meetings obviously changes. So go to April, May, June of 2020. I spent all my time on phone calls, essentially, or town hall meetings, letting senior diplomats know what the situation in real time was in New York City. And on the other end, asking them to connect me to their foreign ministries so I could essentially ask for donations of PPE and ventilator parts. So that was it. There's a lot of talking involved in my job. Prior to that, much of it, and this is what I've really enjoyed about being in government when I have been able to be very entrepreneurial. So it's not only meeting diplomats, whether they are representing our consular corps or different member states with the UN. It's about identifying opportunities to work with them and partner them on policy issues. And so that's a very substantive sort of strategic thinking kind of exercise that I got to spend many years doing. So that every day wasn't just meeting, but it was brainstorming with my teams, what kind of programs can we then launch that we can better sort of get some collective action on issues that we know we care about, whether it's gender equity or climate change. When people think about international diplomacy, there is that aspect of building relationships for the sake of peace. But it really is about that peace is like the fundamental of that is how do we work together to do X, Y, and Z. And so we have, I believe really strongly, this has to do a lot with my background working on women's rights within the Clinton Global Initiative and with women's rights groups. But it's not about the new ideas, but it's about how are we talking to each other to replicate what's working to accelerate impact in the community. And that has been something that I've used my platform over the last 7-8 years to do at the highest levels, because we do have the most powerful people in, from every foreign government in the world here, you know, within a 20-block radius. So how are we using that to our advantage?
How did you get the job? Like, how do you come into a job like this? Like, you know, when we were talking about having you on, I mean, I imagine it's there's a story there, but it's like you have a very, very specific job in a really specific city. Like, what was the path to get here? What was the sort of, I mean, I imagine you never thought you'd find yourself in this job early on in your career. Or maybe even wasn't aware of the job.
No, I wasn't. I'll be honest, when the mayor's office for appointments reached out for me, I remember looking at the website. It looked like it was from like 1992, and there was like a 100-page PDF on parking. And I was like, oh no, what does a commissioner do? You know, the way I think I came to this job is quite honestly being a hustler for like good deeds and for good issues. You know, my background's in women's rights issues. I'm a survivor, as I mentioned. And so I've always been really, you know, focused on that. The shift into the Clinton Global Initiative was really interesting because I was able to continue to build and promote girls and women's issues, but do it within a context of how do you work with corporations and governments where they're not seeing it as a philanthropic end, but it's core to their business, right? Because when you care about domestic violence in your global supply chain, that's very different from creating a program to empower women over here, right? This is where systemic change can really happen. And how do you try to make it happen with the big players? And so that, I think, helped me learn how to communicate, again, in a very sort of functional, let's work together rather than just having conversations. And so, you know, I know that a senior advisor to the mayor had seen me speak a few times and suggested that they interview me. And my interview with Bill was a 2-hour chat on the porch of Gracie Mansion. He and I both have degrees from SIPA in international affairs. He is very knowledgeable on the topic and really wanted to see this agency live up to its potential, I think, right? Because also at the same time, you know, New Yorkers don't like diplomats, and that's a real shame. And it's because the city's really historically not done anything to make this connection between the diplomatic corps and why it's important that we get to host it. How do we benefit from it? Not just economically, because we do, but from the cultural, educational aspect. How do our kids benefit? And so those, I think, are the kinds of conversations that helped me get in the job. But I'll be honest, part of the reason I needed to create all this programming is, like, my first couple of months, I was doing all these, like, courtesy meetings. And I was like, what is this?
What am I doing?
Like,
yeah.
Hey, you know, but it's kind of like, so it's like super boring. It's just like, we're so glad you're in New York. Let me know if you have, you know, problems with parking. I was like, this seems like a complete waste of somebody important's time when I could actually have been prepared to say, these are the five ways that we can work together, you know, between Sweden and New York City or Kenya and New York City. And how do we grow from there? So that's what I had fun with, is the entrepreneurial part of building that.
And then all of a sudden it's January, February, March, 2020. And you're like, oh, my job's a little different now. So going back to the beginning of the pandemic, what was that like, the earliest days in New York?
I mean, I'm sure you've asked this of other people. If anybody has anything better than to say surreal, I just, like, really applaud them. So not to, this is my one and only name drop, but I had the opportunity to go to Davos for the first time. I went in January 2020. I spoke at two sessions, one with three heads of state. And I remember the TV at Davos that they were showing was, do you remember where they were building that 5 or 10,000 person hospital in Wuhan?
Yeah.
But we were watching it like it's reality TV. Like, that is so cool that they can build a 5,000, you know, person hospital in the space of a week.
Yeah.
And all I remember thinking is, these are the smartest people in the world. Cause it's like Davos is the end of January. And then we ended up here in February and back in the city in February. And we were starting to get this information, but it still felt so removed. And I give you that example of watching that show as a reality. It still felt so removed until the first calls really started coming in, right? There was, you know, we had our first case. I can't remember the exact date, but the current head of FEMA, she was our head of emergency management, and she was holding tabletop exercises. We had to figure out, you know, there were far more important people at the table than I am, but I do represent the largest diplomatic corps, so I was invited to the conversation. And how we can manage all of this, but again, it felt very surreal because it still felt very far away. And then cases just started to happen. It happened exponentially. Last spring, you know, we had up to 800 people dying a day. And that was one of the most overwhelming conversations I've ever had with anyone, much less the diplomatic corps. I had a 400 person call where I had to say, if you're sick, you likely have it. If you're not dying, please don't go to the hospital. We are overwhelmed. And what was really interesting is the majority of diplomats, senior diplomats, stayed. I don't know everybody's specific reason for staying, but I do think that foreign governments were really curious to see how a city our size was handling this, right? As we were, like, essentially drinking out of a fire hose. And what I had to do personally is just figure out, how do we shift all of these partnerships that we've been building over the last 7 years into something functional for New Yorkers? And it became something as basic as procuring PPE.
Yeah.
On March 28th, the UN gave us a historic donation of PPE from their own stockpile on HQ campus. They've never done that before. And that is, you know, very telling of, I think, this diplomatic corps never anticipated being on the front lines, not here in New York City. Mm.
And also, you know, what you projected outward to the rest of the world. I mean, you mentioned IDNYC, which is such an interesting program that not enough people really know about. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be this example of how the things you're doing locally can really spread globally. Mm-hmm. So I'd love you to go into a little bit more of that and why something that seems so simple is so profound and could spread so far.
IDNYC was an early example of how we can do that. Paris was actually very quick to pick up on IDNYC. And so just to bring it back a little bit on IDNYC, it's an ID card that anybody can get if they can just prove that they lived in New York City for 3 months. This ID card helps you navigate the NYPD. It helps pick up your kids from school, access all city services, et cetera. Then, of course, there was the concern about, you know, and this was pre-Trump, the concern about what about that information we're getting from those that are undocumented. We worked very carefully with, you know, everyone that was necessary to ensure that this protected information, which became critical when the Trump administration came into power. So that was one thing. It was also really important. How do you destigmatize this card? You don't want just the most vulnerable having this IDNYC card. So the big push was, let's make it the New York City card. And so what we did, we actually did a pop-up on UN campus. We signed up like 1,200 UN employees because, again, they're New Yorkers. Ban Ki-moon got one and made a great statement where he's like, I've been in New York for 13 years, but now I feel like a real New Yorker. And this card was also attached to 40 or 50 cultural institutions that you could get in for free. And so now millions of people have this IDNYC card, but the functional reason is that our most vulnerable have a way of navigating our city in a dignified way. Now, there are a number of examples of IDNYC being replicated around the country, but it was very powerful for Paris to bring it on. And that's really what was the starting point and thinking of, you know, we believe that government should work for the people. And therefore, these are the policies that we are both trying out here. We can see what's working, but we also have the humility to know that we can learn from other countries. And so we created what's called Global Vision Urban Action. And that was really based on the Sustainable Development Goals. How can we take New York City's expertise, experience, share it with the world, and at the same time be creating that feedback loop by connecting with our counterparts in other cities and states? And so we have really, over the last 7 years, focused on that policy exchange, whether it's been on sanitation, gender equity, climate. We just had another hurricane, right? I mean, it's just everything. It just seems to be we're drinking out of a fire hose. And, you know, when COVID happened, one of the first things we did, a colleague in LA created a WhatsApp group with all of our counterparts. And it was just like, what are you doing with homeless people? What are you doing around you? And that became a really important point of contact and connectivity, because everybody's on a different spectrum of where COVID was hitting too. It's like everybody knew it was coming. And I hate to have this observation, but I feel like our colleagues internationally almost got it a little bit more than our counterparts, maybe to our political right. That here in the US, I don't know if you guys saw Mara Gray's excellent op-ed about, you know, if all Americans had seen themselves as New Yorkers, why are we seeing some of these numbers now? And I just reflect on that connection we had with our international counterparts during the height last spring.
You've advocated widely, consistently, loudly about the need to get vaccinated.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, how do you think New York's doing right now in relation to the rest of the country and the world?
So good. When you preface that, I was like, oh my God, what am I advocating? Yes, get vaccinated. And I will say, and it's been really important, you know, during ANGA, we actually put out a free get tested and get a J&J shot right outside of UN campus, made it free for any delegates that were coming in from any part of the country, right? There's vaccine equity issues that we see in our five boroughs, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think we're doing an excellent job. I believe that you guys are following what the mayor and our health department are doing, but we are leading on mandates. I believe yesterday was the deadline for all New York City school teachers and Department of Education staff. I have a son that just started kindergarten 2 weeks ago. That matters to me. New York City is doing incredibly well. I think we're leading the way on vaccine mandates. I will say there are obviously still pockets of communities that are uncertain. And what we have really done is focus on how do we ensure that we're working with community organizations, religious institutions, following the data. So these mobile vehicles, like the one we parked outside the UN, are going to these neighborhoods that have low rates, right? At this point, I believe we have given 10 or 11 million shots. We need to get the rest of New Yorkers on it. It's too much of a discrepancy still between certain neighborhoods and boroughs.
And in terms of the city's restrictions, which have been called France style, basically meaning that if you're not vaccinated, there's fewer and fewer things for you to do, especially indoors. Do you think the city's doing enough? And is there anything you'd like to see the city doing that it's not?
I actually, it's funny that they call it France style because I'm pretty sure we did that before France. Quite honestly, I would just love to see full mandates of vaccines. I got on a plane for the very first time in early September since January of 2020. I still don't understand how you can get on a plane or public transportation without being vaccinated. But again, with what the Biden administration's done with companies, 100 and more, this is where it needs to start coming, is from the mandates. The school move is really an important focus area. I'm from LA originally. What Governor Newsom is doing in terms of mandates for kids to be vaccinated is something I'd like to see New York City do. Mm-hmm.
And Biden recently announced that fully vaccinated international travelers will be welcome to the country starting in November. What does this mean in terms of New York City, how it operates? And just from your sort of vantage, what sort of impact do you see this having?
You know, that was actually a really big announcement for me in the work that I do. The diplomatic corps represents industries and tourism. It's been really hard and I think confusing to our international counterparts that if they are vaccinated by a WHO FDA approved vaccine, why they couldn't travel given all the testing that is required. I don't have insight into why not, but these are the majority of conversations, to be quite honest, that I've been party to over the last 6 to 8 months. It's just been a huge source of frustration for the diplomatic corps and how they have to then represent it to their business and tourism communities back home as to why they can't travel. So that's going to definitely ease it up. Listen, our tourism, our businesses, we welcome them. What we have tried to prove, and this, it's not just been UNGO. Over the last few weeks, we hosted successfully the US Open. I know this sounds silly, but the Met Gala. But the big things that are these points in a calendar for New York City, we've been able to do. I think the priority of this administration has been to say, we are opening up. We want to welcome back business and tourists, but we want to do it as safely and as cautiously as possible. That is why we literally have vans on every other street for free COVID testing. Mm-hmm. Vaccines are available to anyone, even tourists. Times Square, you can get your J&J shot if you're staying for longer than that, Pfizer, Moderna.
It's amazing.
It's like, that's what we should all be doing. That is how cities are going to open up.
Yeah, it's incredible to pass these vans where you can get a free vaccine, whereas a few months ago, it was like, I hope I can get one. You're trying to get one in other places.
I mean, we have jumped the shark now because it's like we're having to incentivize.
Yeah.
No, but it's like, here's $100. I think it's good. We need to do it. I get it.
Yeah.
But there's a part in my head, because I work in like global development,
yeah,
where there's such a need and such vaccine inequity, how, you know, everyone who can take it isn't taking it right now. But to answer your question, we are very excited to know that these vaccinated, tested folks will be coming back. Mm.
On a totally different note, maybe a byproduct of the pandemic, violence has definitely been on the rise in the city in the last year, year and a half. Do you think that people from outside of New York view the city as safe anymore after a period where it was largely thought of as safe? How do you think the international community is viewing New York from a safety perspective now?
Listen, violence is up, but these are extraordinary times, right? So it's also the circumstances in which it's happening, but it's also, you know, I think it's important to show what we're doing in terms of how we are activating with the community and not just from a policing perspective, but we're building back out of an extraordinary period of time where people were out of work. The mental health issues have been extraordinary pre-pandemic and just got exacerbated in that pandemic. From the conversations that I'm having, you know, folks are still kind of laughing about how they thought New York was dead about a year ago. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys remember,
totally,
like all the summer coverage. Yeah,
the city is over.
The city is over. You know, I spend a lot of time with colleagues from Europe, Africa, Asia, I mean, the entire world, and everybody is dying to come back to New York City. And UNGA was a perfect example. It was very disappointing when the UN, thankfully, and the President of the General Assembly, they wanted to be as cautious as possible, the State Department and the U.S. mission, the UN. So they asked for a much limited UNGA. Mm-hmm. But people were jonesing to come back to New York City. I do not think that the safety issues is like 1984.
Right. We just have the Citizen app now, so you're just more aware of it.
Exactly where they, which neighborhood is in. Yeah. I do think it's overblown. And what's interesting about considering it is how dead everybody thought the city was not even like 9 months ago. Mm-hmm. And it is like, are you guys based here?
Yeah.
Yep.
We're in West Chelsea.
Okay. So like New York is back.
There was like, a very short window where you probably should have bought an apartment, but that was over very quickly.
That was like May 2020.
Yeah, exactly. It's incredible how quickly that shifted too. You know, just the economics of real estate here.
Yeah.
Where I think a lot of landlords were thinking, am I going to get rent? And now the rent prices are higher than they've ever been.
That's a New York cycle.
Exactly. Exactly. I did want to also talk a bit about school. You're a parent. I'm a parent.
Yeah. How old is yours?
We have three. We have a 14-year-old, a 12-year-old, and an 8-year-old.
Yep. Oof. Okay. Yeah. Mine started COVID in three, and he's five now. That was like the sweet spot age of no drama.
Yeah. I mean, personally, we had a great time. But it's very rare that you can have all three in the house that much. But you know, it is interesting, and I wanted to talk to you a bit about like the importance of in-person schooling, because that was a big decision to make here. And as a parent, I was wondering how you both dealt with it from a personal perspective of all of a sudden having two full-time jobs in the house while you're working through it, and then how you felt about getting kids back in school that weren't vaccinated, and sort of what do you do with that issue?
You know, so my son, he's only child. We're on the Upper West Side. He didn't interact with another person because we stayed in the city and didn't pod because of the kind of work that my husband and I do. So he didn't interact with anybody for about 3 months. And then going into summer when playgrounds opened, I remember talking to the health commissioner at the time, who's a friend of mine, Oxirius Barbeau. She's a pediatrician too. And, you know, everybody's like, are the playgrounds safe? I found out for the first time, the parks commissioner is also a friend of mine, Mitchell Silver, that they don't clean the playgrounds. And I was like, ew. And he's like, Benny, how can we possibly clean all the, we have tens of thousands of playgrounds. Commissioner Barbeau had said, listen, you have to weigh like the mental health of your son getting back into play with what we don't know about COVID. And that was just a really powerful conversation for me to have, because as a parent, you know, nothing is perfect and you're constantly weighing what you think is right for him or her. And that's when I realized, you know, he has been brilliant about masking. It was really important for us, especially at his age, to not terrify him about COVID. He just kind of thought, after being a daycare kid, he like won the lottery getting to be at home with us all day. And we were just like, you gotta wash your hands all the time. We can't touch anybody. And we're wearing a mask and made the mask a cool thing. He thinks he's a ninja, all of that. So if he was, you know, washing his hands and masked in the playground, that was our first like entry back into society. So we did that. And then getting him back into school via camps and stuff in September, fall, that to me was, he actually feels more responsible than some adults that I know in terms of how to take care, in terms of space and masking. And that to me is so valuable in terms of how he's able to interact. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed, but like kids talk louder now because they're talking through their masks. You know, he recognizes kids on the street. And I was like, how do you know that's Aiden? And he's like, oh, I noticed what he wore today. And I was like, oh, good for you. But it's like, they know how to adapt in a way. I'm hoping the 5 to 12 vaccine will come out soon. But he's in public school, kindergarten. And between all the safety precautions and the vaccines, I feel incredibly safe with him in, and think it's really important that kids are back socializing and connecting. Mm. I don't know if you noticed this, but the playground scene last summer was kind of violent and wild. And it's because you had parents that were kind of just like working on the sidelines, kids that had been in the house all day and they hadn't interacted and they forgot how to have tension.
Yeah.
How to, you know, like, wait, this kid like bumped into me and it like became a thing. And I thought those are those little nuances that kids from, you know, toddler years to teenage years need to know how to navigate with their peers. So between the masking and the vaccine mandates for the adult, I feel really good about it.
Mm. What's next for you?
Ooh.
Can you talk about it? Do you know?
Well, I'm definitely transitioning. I've had 8 incredible years. Yeah. So I'm transitioning after this term. I would really like to go into international development, really focused on children's rights, you know, if you look at the institutions in the space, many are doing excellent work, but so much of it still happens through a neo-colonial lens.
Yeah.
And that needs to change. I think it's going to change in the next 20 years. And I'd like to be part of the leadership that takes it into that direction. And so I'm really excited about potentially going into work like that.
Mm. And as you leave, what city initiatives or projects are giving you kind of the most hope for the future? What are you seeing that you're really excited about and giving you hope?
Quite honestly, the way that we managed an unprecedented pandemic in modern times. You know, the thing about New York City is that our numbers are so overwhelming. When we had to shut down the school system, this wasn't a couple of thousand kids, it was a million plus. And the majority of them get their one or two warm meals a day from the school. So we shifted almost immediately into ensuring that everybody had access to healthcare, a roof over their heads, and food. And so we created Food Czar. One of my favorite former commissioners, Kathy Garcia, who ran for mayor.
Who we love.
I love her. Like, she really can run everything.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that she's at state. She became our Food Czar because almost right away, we knew that the majority of kids needed food to be provided from them. Almost immediately, oh no, their families do too. How do we do that? And I'm not going to point to one policy, but I'm going to point to a flexibility. If you believe that government should work for its people, there is a ton of bureaucracy that we all have to navigate. But really, you know how you can be entrepreneurial within government. And that is something I've personally enjoyed doing with my office and with my team here at the UN. But really, I have seen that throughout all of the work of my sister agencies, whether it's been in parks and the investments in parks throughout our five boroughs and the most, you know, underserved areas, our Commission on Human Rights, our work with consumer affairs, everything that we do, we have shown that our priority has been our community, and we've pivoted into that, and COVID just sort of ramped that up. Mm. So that gives me a lot of hope. It's the people that are in government.
Mm. Thank you so much for joining us today. This was such a great conversation.
Thank you for having me. It was such a pleasure. You guys have an awesome podcast. So thank you so much for inviting me to participate.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter exploring the five senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.